Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Hour 2. My name is Michel Chosudovsky. This program, broadcast out of Texas by the Republic Broadcasting Network, comes to you from Montreal. It's an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. And our guest is, who joins us from the United Kingdom of Great Britain, London, is Felicity Arbuthnot, distinguished writer, journalist, who has traveled to Iraq over many, many years. In fact, how many times have you been to Iraq?
30 until they threatened to definitely kill me when democracy came to Iraq in 2003. So between
that was your last visit, or have you been back since then?
No, I haven't. I'm well prepared to take risks, but I'm not prepared to commit suicide.
But I think that was really to you in 2003 was really, and you left virtually at a very dangerous moment.
I did, and actually I would have stayed, but I had some tapes that I absolutely had to get out, and I was far more concerned about your southern neighbours than I was about the Iraqi regime, and that was why I left. But I have to tell you, Iraq has my heart completely broken. I think history will never, ever forgive us, Britain and America, for what they engineered to get their hands on the oil. And now we discover natural gas in Basra. Well, well, well.
But it's all, actually, it's all Bin Laden's fault, is it not, really? I mean, that's what, at least what I read in some of the British media, press, American media.
Don't believe everything what you read in the media.
No, but I thought it was Bin Laden. He attacked, well, we just had a one-hour discussion with David Ray Griffin on the 9/11 attacks. And then we have, isn't this a humanitarian war to knock off Saddam Hussein and instill democracy?
If you class humanitarian being 4 million displaced, 5 million child, this is since 2003, 5 million child orphans, according to the Iraq Solidarity Campaign, 1 million widows, 400,000 suffering from wasting disease, that means lack of protein, total deficiencies, which means stunted growth and impaired intellect, just in 5 years. Well, that's something. But the interesting thing is, I mean, it seems to me the threat in the Middle East we've been sold is Al-Qaeda, you're absolutely right, Bin Laden, Saddam, as was, and, of course, Islamic fundamentalism and patriotism. If we look now at the threats to Bolivia and Venezuela, it seems to be catalysm and socialism and patriotism. I mean, and today all the banks are falling down like, dominoes, cards, whatever. Where are we going to end all this nonsense?
Well, I think that action is directed against any country which attempts to have any element of sovereignty, which doesn't really, it doesn't need to be a socialist or whatever country. It's any country which doesn't toe the line of the Anglo-American Empire. I think that really is what we're dealing with.
Saddam, Venezuela, Bolivia have something particularly in common, and indeed Iran, another target if there's a bank left standing.
Felicity, we have to unfortunately go to commercial break.
Sure.
We'll be back after the break with our guest, Felicity Arbuthnot. This is Michel Chosudovsky with the Global Research News Hour. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization, broadcast out of Houston, Texas, through Republic Broadcasting Network. My name is Michel Chosedowski. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Felicity Arbuthnot, veteran, war correspondent, writer, human rights activist, is our guest. She's based in the United Kingdom of Great Britain. We call it the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Okay. That's right.
Of course, you have Irish connections as well.
I certainly do, but from the wrong part of Ireland.
We weren't too
happy with the Brits.
Oh, you're from the wrong part. I'm from the right part of Ireland because my mother's family comes from Belfast.
You might even be allowed here without being considered a terrorist. We were saying...
Yes, and she's a Protestant on top of that, so I'm all right, you know.
There you go, you see. You're okay.
To get serious, Felicity, your writings above, I think, anybody else's have always focused on the plight of civilians. I mean, the impacts of strategic decisions taken at a high level and their impact on millions of people in the countries of the Middle East, but particularly Iraq and Afghanistan. Invariably those civilian deaths are always disregarded, and then they say it's collateral damage, etc., and that we don't even have proof of civilian deaths in some cases, in the case of Afghanistan. And then just about a week ago, September 9th, the BBC and various other networks reported some 60 children, 15 women killed in a US-led raid, and it's all on video, and of course the Pentagon can't deny that this actually took place, but in fact this is something which is quite routine.
If you remember, they just said only only the terrorists were killed in the room. I think the figure they originally gave was 7, and then it went up. How do you tell a terrorist when you're at, you know, 30,000, 50,000, whatever feet? Anyway, you know, little villages, and I seem to remember there is something quite strong in the Geneva Convention which says you cannot even bomb a military installation if you think there's one civilian inside. And the report that came out from that, and I think it was 60 children, you're right, 15 women and others. That's a way to win hearts and minds, isn't it? Kill the babies and the women. There was an embedded reporter who happened to be Oliver North with Fox News. Oliver North.
Oh, he was right there.
He was right there on the spot. He is now a seeker of truth. That Oliver North, as in Iran-Contra and all the games that went on there. I mean, really, these revolving doors are absolutely stunning. But he didn't find bits of people everywhere and bits of babies and little hands and little feet and things. No, just 7 terrorists. The original number, which came through Fox News correctly.
But is it not ironical that just a week before these events, President Nicolas Sarkozy, as well as the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, they were mourning the deaths of their soldiers in the battlefield, and they're asking the question, but why are they shooting at us? We're there for some kind of humanitarian undertaking. It's a very cynical.
I think undertaking is it. You know, really, Britain and America have become a nation of undertakers. I mean, there's a very good couple of lines in Michael Clare's book, Blood and Oil. And he just ranges across, and for anybody who sort of glazes over at sort of economics, this is so readable. And he says the bill, including the cost of keeping troops in Iraq, the Gulf, the Caspian Basin, and Colombia, hasn't even got as far as Venezuela, Bolivia, etc. yet. But, I mean, it is the most extraordinarily, almost prophetic book. He says, ultimately, the cost of oil will be measured in blood, the blood of American soldiers who die in combat, and the blood of many others, the casualties of oil-related violence. And then he says the toll from oil-related terrorism, including 9/11, is even greater, a future conflict. And then he goes to, you know, Iran, counterinsurgency in Central America, et cetera, will produce many, many more casualties. And then he asks the question, is any level of blood sacrifice in the protection of overseas petroleum morally justifiable? And that, it seems to me, is what it's about. And again, in Afghanistan, the Taliban, who, of course, were trained by America to defeat the Russians in the 80s, had just refused a pipeline through only about 5 weeks, wasn't it, before the attack on them in October 2001. So, I mean, you know, I just think we're looking at stuff here which is so appalling, so dishonest, historically dishonest. I mean, I just wonder, you know, we have become the terrorists. Britain and America have really become the terrorists. The people they are fighting are trying to defend their own country. And if you stand in the shoes of Britain and America, if, whatever, you know, pick your country, invaded, we would do exactly the same thing.
That's what it was. That was called la résistance in France.
There was a resistance.
La résistance.
Yes.
Yeah, and actually, Nazi Germany said that the people who were fighting in the résistance were terrorists. So that in effect, the discourse is quite similar to what the Nazis used in relation to the resistance movement in countries occupied during World War II. There's one thing that strikes me there, and the 9/11 took place on the 11th of September 2001.
Yes.
The invasion of Afghanistan was, if I remember correctly, was on the 7th of October 2001.
Yes, I was in Canada at the time, actually. So yes,
that's less than one month. Let's say 4.5 weeks. Now, I'm just asking you, how long does it take to organize a major theater war in the Middle East in terms of logistics?
Months.
Oh, you don't need to give me a precise.
No. Months and months and months.
Absolutely.
And I remember very clearly Bush saying, you know, we're not going to do anything reckless. I'm a patient man. If under a month is a patient man, heaven help us if he gets reckless. Well, he has. Yes.
I'm just thinking of the chronology there, because they declared the war on the 12th of September, right?
Yes.
Against Afghanistan. They didn't even know whether Afghanistan was behind the attacks of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But on the 12th, and then NATO, one would assume that NATO had to convene to take that decision under Article 5 of its charter,
yes.
Which says an attack against one member is an attack against all members, and they declared the war within 24 hours. Now, was this all cooked in advance? I guess I know the answer to that question, but in any case.
There's a very interesting letter which was written in 1979 to Joseph Luns, who became the Secretary General of NATO, by Alexander Haig Jr., General of the United States Army, who had just retired, who actually basically they cook up a scenario, or Haig suggests to Luns, that country by country, if Europe doesn't fall into line with what NATO requires, that they, right, having persuaded the media and everybody else, we're left with no alternative but we would call for appropriate and effective action of a sensitive nature, which we have frequently discussed. I mean, I'm looking at terrorists for us. Did this actually, has this been a doctrine that sort of started then and then continued? Do you see where I'm going?
Well, I certainly see that, and if we look at the project for the New American Century, it's very clearly enunciated. They said we will wage simultaneous large-scale theater wars in different parts of the world, and we will have these constabulary forms of intervention in countries we don't like, etc. It's very clearly laid out. It's what you'd call guerre sans frontières, war without borders.
Absolutely. But what they all have in common is that they have oil and gas,
or narcotics.
Or narcotics.
Or narcotics. Well, Afghanistan is a very rich country. It generates $200 billion worth of revenues to the Western financial institutions through the narcotics trade.
It does now. It's the biggest supplier, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
Young kids falling around the streets of London, Birmingham, New York, whatever. It all comes from Afghanistan. The cynic would say it looks very similar to the sort of South American wars of the 80s.
Felicity, we'll have to take a short break. We'll be back with Felicity Arbuthnot after the break. This is the Global Research News Hour.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. We provide on our website a daily coverage of the news with feature articles, in-depth reports. We also have a publishing program, so come and visit us. There's a newsletter. And among our distinguished authors is our guest, Felicity Arbuthnot, veteran war correspondent and human rights activist. Felicity, just to change the subject a little bit, because you are an astute observer of British politics, and I understand that your distinguished Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, is now in discussions with the Pakistani government, or more precisely with the president of Pakistan, because the Americans want to now extend the war from Afghanistan into Pakistan.
Well, actually, yes, and Pakistan is fairly fed up, because the mice that roared, our great ally, by the way, on the war on terrorism, as America and Britain are so keen to tell us, they're a bit fed up of being bombed by America from Afghanistan, and Pakistan today actually fired a missile at an American plane. Dear, oh dear, there's trouble in paradise, isn't there? But I really don't think that what Gordon Brown has to say is cutting much mustard anywhere on the planet at the moment. I mean, this is a man with his fingernails down to the quick, literally bleeding, who his own party at the moment are giving him such a kicking that today they've had so many people actually in quite high positions in government saying, time to go, Gordon, this is all a disaster. But he had to put out an announcement today that he'd sacked the third senior person who had spoken out and said, time to go. And the third senior person has just put out a statement saying, actually, I resigned. I mean, that's desperation or what from the Prime Minister's office. So I really don't think what Gordon Brown can say anywhere on the planet is going to have well, as I say, cut much mustard at all. I wish I could feel sorry for him.
No, but I mean...
But I haven't had so much fun for a long time.
Yes, but he's less sort of categorical than his predecessor, Tony Blair, who's still remembered. Because, I mean, as far as this Pakistani crisis... He's not condemning the attacks on Pakistan, but he's not, at the same time, he's not siding overtly with Americans' decision now to send in men and equipment into Pakistani territory.
I mean, how outrageous! And this is Gordon Brown all over. You know, he was going to have an election, then he didn't have an election. He was going to make a particular tax thing which hit the most, the lowest waged, really hard working people, and then he had to basically pay it back, and then he did something else. And he, you know, every time, I mean, if you are looking for a decision and a backbone, Gordon Brown is not the place to go. So, you know, I'm sorry for the Pakistanis in their trouble, but, I mean, this man is a waffling disaster.
But so no fundamental shift in policy direction when compared to his predecessor. It's not. He seems to be a little bit less decisive, but it's continuity as far as.
Oh, I think it is, and I honestly think in David Miliband, the little foreign secretary, I mean, I really don't think this man, I think he's extremely ambitious, but he's not one of, you know, over the years, Britain has had, you might not have always agreed with them, but they understood global realpolitik. They understood the world. They spoke languages. They, you know, they did study complex areas of the world.
But that was colonial Britain.
I suppose it was, but even after colonial Britain, you look at people like Alec Douglas Hume and Howe and various people, they did understand, they were prepared to listen, they were prepared to talk, even if they were a bit colonial and arrogant, but they talked to people. You just now have this U.S. coattails diplomacy, and, you know, when you look at the U.S. politics across the globe, I mean, when they set themselves up in Kurdistan and the CIA and Israel in 1994, they had one person for a very long time who even spoke Arabic or Kurdish. You know, but this is where Britain takes its lead from, and I think it's extremely alarming.
We'll have to be going to a short commercial break again. Yes, but I think what you have suggested here, first of all, there is an Anglo-American alliance that remains, and secondly, what's happened in recent weeks is the opening up of new areas of intervention by the United States and its indefectible British ally, namely in South America, in Bolivia, threats on Venezuela, of course the situation in Georgia, Pakistan, and it's in that sense that we are moving towards this global war without borders. We'll be back after the break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michel Chosadovsky. This is an initiative of our research center based in Montreal, the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We are joined in the second hour of this program by Felicity Arbuthnot, veteran war correspondent, analyst of the ongoing Anglo-American military adventure and its devastating humanitarian consequences. Felicity, we were discussing before the break the issue of how this war, in fact, is now extending into new frontiers.
It is. Yep.
I mean, just a few weeks ago, we had a very different vision of the world.
Yes, and it was bad enough then. I think it's been overlooked if we do this huge sort of quantum leap from the Caspian. You know, Georgia suddenly blew up and people were saying, well, we never saw that coming. No, we didn't. But America moved in there in 1992, just after the Soviet Union, if you will, sort of dissolved, then started pushing, and we go back to that letter again, the plan all along to scare people out of their wits, to push the former Eastern Bloc into NATO. Then you sort of leap, and I was looking this up today to make sure I wasn't completely sort of delusional. Venezuela and Bolivia, which are now the two hate figures. It just happens that they both have very small armies, very small armed forces. But guess what? Bolivia, which, you know, is sort of off the radar, has huge natural gas. It has tin, tungsten, zinc, petroleum. Colombia down the road has petroleum, natural gas. So you're looking at sort of being in the central area of Venezuela. Venezuela, petroleum, natural gas, gold, diamonds in significant quantities. A lot of stuff like bauxite, which is needed for all engines of vehicles and so on. And then just down the road, we've got Ecuador and Peru, petroleum, gold, silver, copper, etc., etc. Brazil down the road from there, gold, diamond, petroleum. And, of course, water's getting short. Brazil has hydroelectric power. So there's all sorts of stuff here. You're looking at a sort of... Are you looking at a resources war? You're the economist. Tell me.
Well, I think it definitely is a resources war, but it's also the conquest of institutions, of territory. It's not strictly based on the quest for oil and natural gas. There are other resources. There's also the use of these massive reserves of labor. But what I think at this particular juncture is worth underscoring is the fact that, well, Bolivia is a major energy economy, and so is Venezuela.
Absolutely.
And so is Ecuador.
Yes.
And this is where the military interventions are taking place. But there's something else. Philip Goldberg, this ambassador, was thrown out, poor fellow. Now, he actually did his homework in Kosovo, of all places.
Goodness me. The Treblinka mine. When I remember the manager saying, you know, people were saying, why are we fighting for Kosovo and all the rest of it? And he said the mine was so valuable. He said the Treblinka mine is Kosovo's Kuwait.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes, of course I remember that, but also what strikes me in this Kosovo connection is, and we discussed that on the phone day before yesterday, is the fact that Philip Goldberg was sent from Kosovo. He was the U.S. head of mission, and then he became ambassador in Bolivia after having engineered the secession of Kosovo and essentially breaking up Serbia.
Yes.
And previously he was in Bosnia. And then you had another fellow, James Foley, who was the liaison man at NATO in Brussels at the time of the wars in Yugoslavia, and who was also involved in Kosovo, as a sort of liaison with the Kosovo Liberation Army, knowing that, of course, that organization is also linked to organized crime. And then what happens? He's sent off to Haiti as ambassador. And then in 2004, what you have? You have a military coup with paramilitaries and so on. And it seems that they're sort of, they have some kind of a blueprint, and they just take these fellows and shift them around from one country to another, and say, you know, replicate whatever you've done in your previous.
Absolutely. Well, I think John Negroponte is a very good example, isn't he? I mean, he caused sort of mayhem and murder in Central America in the 80s, and what does he do? Pitches up in Iraq after the invasion. I mean, you could go on and on with these names.
But in fact, right now, it seems that Negroponte, who occupies the number two position at the State Department, he's second after Condoleezza Rice, but in fact, most probably is far more important as a key figure because he coordinates all these actions.
Yep.
And so there's a what? Because essentially we have this understanding that an embassy is a respectable institution, and that you you don't really run covert operations from an embassy. Is that?
I think you'd probably be incredibly naive if you believe that of most embassies on the planet. I think that's where, you know, all the nightmare scenarios that we wake up at 3 a.m, you know, really having nightmares about are hatched. And I do think that, particularly in the last sort of, would it be 25, 30 years, the idea of, you know, genuine, we go back to the sort of Alex Douglas Humes and so on, genuine, I'm not saying they were perfect, but I'm saying they were better, diplomacy seems to have just completely been ditched. And I think there's a slightly, I don't know what the word is, galling thing, but very often you look at people who've been set up as absolute demons, and certainly Saddam was not the nicest man on the planet. But he said in 1990, he gave a speech and he said, he warned Middle East, for instance, leaders, and there have been others like this, and he said, unless we all pull together, and he was talking about the sort of fractious nature of what should be sort of pan-Arab nationalism, which never happens, and they all squabble between themselves, and, you know, even sensible people from the region say, why do we, you know, why are we all so separated? And he said, America will basically take over all the great resources in our region and others, and will dominate them. And everybody was saying what a bad, wicked man he was. He was spot on right, if you read that speech. I mean, I've not done it justice. Absolutely spot on.
Absolutely. Well, it's. I think one should look at the arithmetic of the oil resources.
Yes.
America is, what, 2%? Western countries combined have about 4% of global oil and gas,
yep,
reserves. And the Middle East, Central Asia, from the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian,
yep,
Sea basin, something of the order of 60%. And then Muslim countries combined have something close to 70%, 66% of global,
yes,
oil and gas,
yes,
reserves.
I was looking for those figures today. You've put it absolutely spot on, yes.
Well, I actually estimated them from, well, as far as the Muslim countries are concerned, it's between 66 and 69%, depending on what, you know, what, how reliable these statistics are. But,
yeah,
again, it means just a country like Iraq has 5 times more oil reserves than the United States of America,
yes,
with a population of 24 million people. So, I mean, it's that region is, of course, very, very strategic from the point of view of oil and gas.
It is. There's a very interesting thing that slightly links in with that. In the end of, when was it, 1990, it was September 1991 when the weapons inspectors first went into Iraq. I don't know if your listeners will remember, but you probably will. There was a standoff in a car park when they'd gone into a building and taken a whole pile of documents. And they were held, I think, for 2 days and nights because the Iraqis said that they had taken all the names of all the top scientists in Iraq who actually were responsible for everything from weapons to oil, you know, all the things that made the country run, and they did, to be fair, feel threatened too, so whatever. And they were all the names of the scientists, and they were saying, if you take this list, they will be passed on to Mossad, and people will come here and pick off our scientists. The list, they did get the list out, definitely, and now over 300 scientists have been targeted and shot dead. So Iraq now is in a hugely difficult position to rebuild itself in any meaningful academic way at any level, including even pumping of oil without foreign, not that they haven't taken it over anyway, without foreign help. Which is quite sinister, because Scott Ritter always, you know, has admitted that his way home to Washington was always via Tel Aviv, although they were supposed to be under the auspices of the United Nations. It was just a huge spying gang, you know.
So in other words, what you're saying is that the occupation initially established the list of all scientists and professionals and intellectuals and engineers, and then they put them on a hit list, and that's the way you don't win the war that way, but you destroy the country, and
destroy all the sort of academic basis. But that was as early as September 1991. But it was after the occupation that these academics at every level, and not alone scientists, were just picked off. I mean, the list, I've studied it, you know, on and off for a very long time, and then the figures get more difficult to get. But they have actually definitely been picked off. There's no question.
And then you also, there's another aspect to that, and I think it also emerged in military operations in Yugoslavia, in Afghanistan. You destroy the whole historical memory of a population. You bomb their churches, their museums, their schools, their universities,
their culture, everything. Everything.
And that's something which even the Nazi Germany didn't do, because Paris would be in rubbles if they had. I mean, it's a crime. It's a crime against civilization, in a sense.
It is. It's also destroying humanity's history. I mean, you know, that's a term that I've used. But even in the Iran-Iraq War, 8 years, you know, where America and much of the West were sort of arming both sides in the most appalling, cynical, you know, political sick game, but nevertheless, you know, and it was the most vicious, frightening, dreadful, murderous, absolutely more or less forgotten by the West. But over and over again, you heard both in Iran and Iraq, you know, how they tried to avoid hitting each other's historical things, because they're so precious in that part of the world. They really, really, it is humanity's history. It is what's passed down from generation to generation. It is what makes Persia, Mesopotamia, you know, and they have this huge, huge sense of history. But it took us, the West, to virtually, you know, destroy it. Terrifying.
I recall, I mean, that was early on in the occupation, but it happened, I think, 2003, that there was a decision by the occupation to destroy all data banks in Iraq, okay? Namely, to all the sources of information, tax records, demographic statistics, everything that defines a country at the institutional, administrative, you know, but also its whole history.
But also educational records, birth certificates, marriage
Absolutely.
Certificates. Every single record of civilians that even enables them to, I don't know, get a job, get a passport, do something normal, has been wiped out. I mean, just imagine that. Iraq's year zero. There is no other word for it.
Yeah, they would go into the hospitals, destroy the data banks, they'd go into the schools, knock out the computers and so on, so that, and that was in fact part of Rumsfeld's statement, I think, that he made to drive them back into the Stone Age.
Yes.
And how do you do that? You kill the professionals, the engineers, the scientists, that destroy the data, destroy the history.
That's absolutely it. And now, I mean, they've done what it took the British quite a few years to do, that the sort of new generation of children who should now be able to read and write, between the security situation and the utter destruction of the educational system and so on, there's over 90% illiteracy amongst children in Iraq until 19, even up until the invasion, literacy was about 90%.
Yeah.
Even with the begging, the children on the streets, the you know, the terrible, terrible deprivations of the embargo, they still kept up that educational system somehow. With all sorts of actually terrific ingenuity, because parents used to be arrested if their children didn't go to school, and then the economy was so collapsed that the children had to beg in the morning. So they would do three sessions of school so they could still go in the afternoon or the evening. You know, there was an accommodation for an absolute nightmare. But we haven't brought freedom, democracy, and all the wonderful things that that's supposed to bring. We have actually taken Iraq actually back to a pre-industrial age, exactly as Rumsfeld said.
We'll have to go to another small commercial break, and then we'll be winding up our discussion with Felicity Arbut. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chasadovsky. It's an initiative of globalresearch.ca. And it comes to you from Montreal. Our guest is Felicity Arbuthnot, distinguished author and war correspondent based in the United Kingdom. We were discussing before the break the destruction of institutions, public records, data, the killing of scientists, the assassination of scientists, engineers, academics in Iraq as the basis for destabilizing and ultimately occupying and conquering oil reserves and transforming essentially a country into a territory. There was one thing that struck me, Felicity, in this process of destroying the data and destroying public records, is that the first thing that the occupation forces did was to destroy all public records of all registries of public and private ownership. And then they could come in and privatize because nobody could prove that they owned anything.
Absolutely. And there's a very interesting thing here. Well, actually, various strands, if I may. When a lot of the Iraqi Jews left after the state, the formation of the State of Israel, there was a big bombing campaign in Iraq targeting Jews, and there were all sorts of theories, and I'm sure you know them, but some were, you know, like many places, because they were looking for people to populate Israel. But there was a law drafted then that the homes that they left behind them, if they owned, if they owned them, were they could be leased, but they could never be bought. And if even the descendants came back, those homes must be given back to the descendants of those families. So, you know, even under all the wickedness of Saddam, that still stood. There was a certain honour. And what has happened subsequently, you know, I talked about the over 4 million displaced. Many of those had homes, you know, that they'd bought and so on. They will never be able to go back to them. All that is destroyed. And they've
because they can't prove the ownership.
No, they can't.
Or the building is no longer there, but they can't prove that they actually owned this.
Or owned the land,
yeah.
Absolutely. The other interesting thing is this huge, huge cancers and deformities and so on, which happened since the Gulf War, which have been linked to certainly depleted uranium, but also other weapons that were used in the 1991 war. And the figures are absolutely astonishing, and cancers that develop so fast, and children born with cancer, which is absolutely unheard of. So something terrible went wrong in that war. That means all the health department's records were destroyed too. So that kind of thing, where cases might be brought against the United States in countries where those weapons have been used, all that information, and they were
gone.
Very Germanic about their figures, you know, whether it was for them or against them. They were terribly.
We'll have to.
They've gone. Absolutely.
Well, Felicity, I think we're getting to the end of the program. I thank you very much for joining us. Unfortunately, we have just a few more seconds. Our guest, Felicity Arbuthnot, this is the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. Stay with us. Don't stay with us next week at the same time, 11 Central Time, through the Republic Broadcasting Network.